Welcome to the Podcast Potables Network, part of Underground Sports Philadelphia. You can find all things Underground Sports Philadelphia at Underground PHI. You are listening to Process Potables, brought to you by the Andrew Boss team at Berkshire Hathaway. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast, leave us a 5-star rating, and a review on Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Untappd at Process Potables. For news, info on breweries we've worked with, and more, check out www.processpotables.com. Process Potables is on tap, but first, our friends in the presence of wolves. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Process Potables. My name is Dan, joined by Steve, as usual. This is episode 59, titled, Nice Game, Mike. We're going to get into the last dance from this week, episodes 7 and 8. We're going to go through some news on the NBA's potential restarting, an article I read on The Athletic by Shams, and some of the updates that they give to that, which is somewhat along the lines of what we've discussed over the last couple weeks on this pod, and especially as me and Brandon Apter of the Garbage and the Gold podcast, who came on as a guest in the bonus episode this past week, were trying to speculate a little bit based on statements made by Elton Brand to the media and to the season ticket holder virtual town hall that he did. And a couple other things that we found across some social media platforms and other articles via the Sixers to just get a little Sixers talk in there as we're still missing sports, sticking it out through this quarantine period. Before we get into any of that, Steve, it's Sunday night. We just got done another two episodes of The Last Dance. We only have two more to go. How are you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling pretty good. These were two pretty good episodes. See, the Rodman episode's still my favorite, but these were probably a little bit better than last week, I would say.
I agree with that. These were definitely a lot better than last week. Feels like we're getting back on track and feels like we're set up for a pretty exciting final two episodes. The timing of this whole thing has just been a little off, though, and it's weird now that we're going into the final weekend and we've barely talked about the Jazz at all, who they play, you know, in the last two finals that they win in 96, 97, and 97, yeah. 98, and it feels like they haven't been discussed at all now through 80% of the series. And I'm guessing we're starting episode 9 with Reggie Miller and the Pacers. So
yeah,
you figure they're going to get a decent chunk of that. I don't know how much more flashbacking they need to do, as they've already gotten through the baseball part, through the Space Jam part, and onto him returning for, you know, the second three-peat. So I don't know if there's going to be a whole lot more timeline jumping, but the biggest thing that's surprising me now is getting to this point and having never heard of Karl Malone basically at all, John Stockton basically at all, and things like that. We'll get into The Last Dance, so don't want to get ahead of ourselves. To start off the episode, we're going to give you all the news and stuff that we want to talk about. Before we get into The Last Dance, this is this week's Quick Sips. So in The Athletic, that article we previously mentioned from Shams, the NBA Players Association held a call with NBA players on Friday, which would be 2 days ago, that included an update from the league office and Commissioner Adam Silver. Here's what you should know following the call. If the 2019-2020 season resumes, no fans are expected, and that could be the case as long as there is no vaccine. So not only if they restart this season, but it seems like they're already potentially expecting next season to maybe begin with no fans in attendance. 40% of the league's total revenue comes from fans. So if they're operating as normal and there are no fans, then they basically are only going to make half of the revenue that they normally would.
That's, you know, crazy.
A little bit more than that. That's a number that, I mean, it makes sense, but it's just crazy to see on paper. A decision on the season can go into June. So So we're now in May, and, you know, I guess that could change too. I don't know how in cement that is, but it makes it sound like they're saying if by in some point in June they don't have a plan in place that they feel good about and safe, then that's probably when they're going to decide to can it.
Yeah, that
if they
about
if they
right.
don't have something yeah. by that they won't let it linger on beyond that. If or when the NBA is able to return, Adam Silver told players it is safer in one or two locations, such as Walt Disney World in Orlando and Las Vegas, than it would be flying around to cities and facilities. That makes sense. We've heard that a lot already. The NBA is sifting through, quote, a lot of bad options, unquote, meaning whatever route the resumption could take place is less than ideal. So I think basically that's saying that they don't think any of their ideas right now are really that good or safe or practical, which is kind of what we've been saying this whole time to all the people who are saying, oh, they'll come back soon. And like we've said, the logistics are so much more complicated than I think anybody can truly understand. And it seems like they are well aware of that. So that's not even, I'm not even trying to say that so much in an I told you so way, even though I am a little bit, of course. But I'm glad that they are being this rational about it and being this, you know, cautious, I guess, about this and not rushing to it, even knowing that, you know, the potential revenue lost is in play here. The NBA is projecting a one-year timetable on a coronavirus vaccine. Silver emphasized that the league collectively will have to deal with the coronavirus issue for the foreseeable future and that, quote, no decision will be risk-free, end quote. Silver admitted the NBA, quote, couldn't start now even if we wanted to, end quote.
Wow.
Well, I'm guessing that's because so many states still have a lot of these things off limits. Like, we know that I think, like, Florida was one of the only places that's even, you know, like, they allowed wrestling to keep going, deeming it an essential service. But you're not going to see that in most states. Florida's obviously a fucking shithole.
Yeah, Florida should just be its own country.
NBA teams will be told again that it is voluntary for players to work out and pressure should not be applied. The Players Association President Chris Ball and Vice President Kyrie Irving told Adam Silver that some players have been feeling pressure from teams to return the facilities and that should not be the case, to which Silver agreed and stated any other concerns should be made to the league and the NBA Players Association. Silver admitted there would be a significant impact for the league financially if there is no season and then no fans attending games in 2020-2021. According to Silver, the league would look into other interactive ways to get fans engaged. When asked about a potential second wave of the virus in the fall, Silver said, that is why a delayed start to 2020-2021 makes sense. Silver referenced a Christmas Day start. Sources said the December 25th start to the 2020-2021 season is gaining momentum. The ever-elusive question across pro sports is this. What happens if a player tests positive again? Silver responded that the NBA will be able to administer daily testing at that point, have no stoppage of play, and isolate the player or players in quarantine. Silver cited a potential two-day break as well. Silver stated any decision would need to be worked out with the NBA Players Association, and he has spoken to MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred about a protocol. A 3 to 6 week ramp-up period is expected should the NBA be able to resume the season, and the NBA prefers to have a full 4-round, 7-game per series postseason.
So that's a lot.
That's a lot. The one thing that this isn't even a question to you. The one thing that I take from that, that as we just discussed, giving them credit to a cautious approach, is if you have an entire isolated NBA league, even if you're split between two locations, and you find out even one person becomes infected during that time, one, you can't just take them out and then deem it safe again.
Right.
And two, a two-day break is not long enough to do anything. And this is what we've said several times over when we've discussed this, is that this is the biggest problem, is that you have one flare-up, and everything has to shut down for a much more significant period of time than they just discussed there, contrary to a lot of the positive things they discussed in their protocols and precautions prior to that. Do you agree?
Yeah, it just, to me, kind of, it almost feels like they're selling fool's gold here, right? In that they're making these promises, like, in the event of a vaccine comes much sooner than expected or the curve starts to flatten or everything significantly, I just feel like there's all these plans in place, you know, for the best case scenario, but I don't see any of these scenarios really being realistic, unfortunately. So, and if they wait till, what do they say, till July, restart the season, I just don't see it happening in July. Like, you're going to try to play the end of July through August for playoffs, or that seems really late, even if they were to delay next season to Christmas. So,
yeah, I agree with you. And the other thing I took from that, where Adam Silver stated that he thinks that they are still on pace to want to do the set regular standard playoff thing with the amount of series and the amount of games. To your point, if you're not starting that till July, that can go a while. And I'm surprised at this point that we're not hearing anything about having any...
like maybe 3 to 5 game series?
Having any compromises to that. Yeah. Having a way to shorten that. You know, we've heard rumors, obviously this has all been rumor and speculation, but of having, you know, a larger playoffs, of giving everybody a chance and things like that, which I don't want to do.
No.
Nor agree with, but... I would also entertain. I mean, even just watching The Last Dance night and remembering that the first round used to be 5 games, like, I kind of think I like that better all the time anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if I need the 1-8 matchup to go 7 games at this point. Obviously, we know they probably do it for revenue, but...
yeah, I'm guessing that's the only reason why you haven't heard that. It's just because playoff basketball, playoff any sport, but especially basketball, the ratings and the money you get that is so big. But at the same time, you have to consider, okay, having multiple 7-game series, there's a greater risk and exposure to someone getting the virus. So if we can get 3 to 5-game series, like, there's a good chance you can have the, you know, these full playoffs and no one getting sick or injured from that. So
I don't think having the more games gives you any more exposure. I mean, I kind of get what you're saying, but to that point, if there's an exposure there at all, then that's the reason they shouldn't be doing it in the first place. The likelihood of getting it in 7 games versus 5 is all predicated on the fact that it be there at all. And if it's there at all, then you're fucked. So as of Friday, some teams were able to open their practice facilities. I don't know if it's been made public as to what teams have or have not. It's obviously based on the states that they're in and how strict their, you know, quarantine processes are and how far they go through. I know for Pennsylvania, I believe right now they're up until like June 3rd or 4th, sometime in that first week. I think New Jersey is the same right now. I don't know if he actually made it into June yet. But I do know that some of the Sixers players have had access to the practice facility. I know Ben Simmons has been able to do his rehabbing there, and I think Elton Brand mentioned that Joel Embiid has been there. They do take precautions. I think they've said that, you know, only like 4 guys can be on a court at a time. And obviously, like, the courts there have like 8 nets anyway, so there's plenty of space there even at that point to have the room. But they are limiting how many people can go out there at once and whatnot. So doing the best they can with it. Another thing I thought was interesting as we're talking about The Last Dance was Steve Kerr was on ESPN 1000, and he said, quote, "Everything that I've been able to enjoy and experience in the NBA was a direct result of playing with Michael Jordan," end quote. Then he later said, quote, "And I'm not being falsely modest, it's just the truth." It was also said that the same guy who, like, was the head of this Last Dance documentary was around the Warriors in that last season with Kevin Durant. And apparently was like pushing to do this same style kind of documentary with them. But Steve Kerr was like the guy against it. And he gives further information on that, but it's very interesting. There's an article on The Athletic by John Greenberg. You can check that out. There's a whole ton of little anecdotes in there about, you know, Michael Jordan's impact on, you know, random people throughout professional sports, and especially how it impacts the economy and things like that. So I found that to be a very interesting read. Lastly, this is a little bit of Sixers, and just so we can have a little fun here. We've probably had conversations about each thing at some point a while back, but maybe quarantine has changed your stance, and also I don't know if we've talked about them in the same breath here. There's a mailbag submitted to Mike O'Connor on The Athletic by a reader, and basically the question was, because this has been all over Twitter now for a week or two, I don't know if you've seen all these people suggesting we would be trading Joel Embiid to the Heat.
Oh.
Yeah, fun. So the question basically is, what do you think, you know, would be the better fix for this team right now? Trading Joel Embiid for a large package that gets you, you know, a plethora of different talent to fit in with everybody else who's here, or a trade that is much like one we've discussed before, something like Horford and Josh Richardson for Buddy Hield? So what are your thoughts right now? Would you rather trade Horford and Richardson for Buddy Hield or Joel Embiid for a package of like two or three, you know, wings that can kind of defend and shoot and try to open up Ben Simmons' game some more?
I prefer the package where you trade Horford and Richardson for a Buddy Hield. If you trade Embiid away, there is no way you're winning a title. And just the thought that, like, oh, Ben Simmons just going to go out and just hit guys for open threes and, you know, him never shooting a three, I just don't see that as a way of winning a championship. And I don't see when you trade Embiid, like, having Al Horford with how he's played this past season going forward. Like, do you want him as your starting five without Embiid?
Yeah, that's what,
that's what scares me. And I really like Josh Richardson, but, you know, if you can get someone like Buddy Hield, more of a impact scorer, I think that could be enough to get you to, you know, to the finals, let alone winning one.
Yeah, the way Mike O'Connor pitches it, which is, I mean, honestly, this is probably the best case scenario for either one of those trades, is let's say you flip Embiid for Bradley Beal. Do you think that Ben Simmons, Bradley Beal, Josh Richardson, Tobias Harris, and Al Horford can win a championship?
No.
Not happening. I agree. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're better than this team that we have.
It's interesting because from what I've kind of read and remembered, the one piece that everyone kept saying that you would have to attach to a Horford deal would be a Matisse. Something else, I don't know if I read this on Twitter and I read this article last week, but they also attached that maybe trading the rights to a Micić or whatever his name is, that guy we have stashed in Europe. Apparently, like, they're saying that if he were hypothetically were going into NBA draft this year, he'd be like a top 5-10 guy. So I guess that's an option, but I mean, who really knows? And also too, with the revenue, it's going to have a direct impact on the cap. It might take a whole lot more to get a team to take Horford as a salary dump.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's well beyond the scope of this conversation, but you're exactly right. If it comes to pass that there are significant salary cap implications as a result of all of this, which I am betting that there will be, then, yeah, any kind of move like that is going to be pretty difficult. Elton Brand did say to the media on Tuesday that he has said this before, this has allegedly been a stance of ownership, though we've all questioned how much we truly believe it, that, you know, he has the full support of the ownership group to do whatever it takes to win a title. That includes spending money. That includes, you know, going over the cap. I kind of assume that at this point when he's bringing it up again, that it has to do with the fact that, you know, if the cap is significantly reduced, but we still have this roster, that we're probably going to be pretty far into some kind of luxury tax penalty. Yeah. My only thought is I have to believe that if the cap is significantly impacted based off a freak accident like this, then the league may need to implement some kind of adjustment to that.
Yeah, some sort of like prorating the cap and player salaries. It's like,
well, not even that, but at least the luxury tax part of it, because how are teams supposed to plan for this?
Yeah, you can't.
Like, I would bet that there's at least 10 teams that will end up in like a luxury tax situation they didn't expect as a result of this, based on the percentages we're hearing of, you know, revenue being impacted. You figure that's going to have a pretty strong correlation to the percentage of a cap impact, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
So when he mentions the alternate to the Embiid trade, it is like we said. So it would be, you know, do you think that they're better off if you have Simmons, Hield, let's say Harrison Barnes, Tobias Harris, and Joel Embiid? Do you think that lineup is better than the Beal one we mentioned, and or better than our current team? I mean, I think that one's better.
Yeah, it's definitely better.
The question is, you know, what does the depth look like with a team like that? Because Harrison Barnes makes a good amount of money too, and he's definitely not the same player he was, but he's you can put him out there. He's playable.
Yeah, and he'll definitely have his games where he'll get his, you know, buckets and everything.
He's at least a consistent three-point shooter, and I'd say an average defender, so you get that. I mean, I honestly don't know if you figure his offense is probably a little bit better than Josh Richardson, but his defense is definitely
that's a big drop.
A little worse.
Yeah.
But I don't know if the trade-off is that enormous there. Richardson has the potential to get better, where we know Barnes is on the decline, but as of right now, I don't know that I know that there's that giant amount of separation there.
And again, with the salary cap implications, it might be harder to get a really good proven veteran on like the minimum because of, you know, the impact of COVID. So it's going to be really difficult to predict what the roster is going to look like after this season.
Yeah, I mean, it would be difficult, but you also figure there's going to be all the teams are going to have the same problems. So there's still going to be a bunch of veterans that will need spots, and all the teams are going to have the same issues. So I don't know that that's necessarily a Sixer-specific issue. I think that's going to be a league issue that, you know, is going to impact everybody for the most part pretty evenly. So the other thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Steve, even though this is not an Eagles podcast, but we need sports, and honestly, like, I watched the NFL draft more than I expected to, but I'm not a draft guy in any sport because I know you're the same as me. We don't watch college sports.
No.
So I don't pretend to know a whole lot about it, but I found myself watching a lot more of the NFL draft than I expected this year because what the hell else was I going to do? But I also found myself watching a lot more of the NFL schedule release content than I expected to, and studying the schedule a lot more than I already normally would. This would always be something I'm excited for, but obviously with this huge lapse in sports content, I was all the more engaged, all the more trying to find out some interesting things, look at other teams' schedules and how they line up, look at, you know, aspects of their schedules that impact when they play us, so on and so forth. So the Eagles' schedule comes out on Thursday. They are at Washington. Then they have the Rams at home, the Bengals at home. You go to San Francisco. You go to Pittsburgh. You have the Ravens at home. You have the Giants on a Thursday night at home. Dallas at home. So you have a three-game homestand there, including back-to-back division games. You have the bye week right in week 9. Sweetest bye week there is.
Yes.
Then you go on the road to New York, face the Giants again. You go to Cleveland. You have Seattle at home on Monday night. You go to Green Bay. You have New Orleans at home. Then you're at Arizona, at Dallas. You finish the season with the Redskins at home. Steve, what are your thoughts on the schedule? And I'm going to say right now, man, you give a season prediction.
Well, we start 3-0. I think we win the division. We go maybe 10-6. Because outside of the division, there's going to be some tough games against San Francisco, Green Bay, New Orleans. There's going to be some pretty tough games. But I see us winning the division. Although I didn't love the Eagles draft, I still think we're a better team. And we signed what? Like we now have 28 wide receivers on the roster. So at least a handful of them, I would hope, someone would be good. So definitely be in a better position than last year as far as wide receiver goes.
Yeah, the bye week right in the middle is a big deal to me. I think that's great. I like that the first half of your season, the first 8 games, you only play back-to-back on the road once.
That's good.
You go to San Francisco, and then you come back, and it's Pittsburgh. That's barely a road game.
Yeah.
So that's your only one in the first 8 weeks. Your second road trip is right after the bye, and it's the Giants in Cleveland. Neither one is far. One's right up the turnpike. The other one's Cleveland. And then the last one is pretty tough at Arizona and then at Dallas. So that's the only one that's really bad to me because they're both significant trips, and it's at the end of the season.
Now, what's interesting, too, is I don't know if you read about this. Apparently, how they made the schedule, in a way where if they, let's say, have to push back the season by 4 weeks, that they constructed it where – I think the teams that play in week 3 have the same bye weeks throughout the season. So if they need to cancel bye weeks or push games back, I don't know. It's beyond my understanding, but there's a lot of things with the schedule.
Basically, they made it provide with some flexibility.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's good to know.
Yeah, and where the Super Bowl could even be pushed back to the end of February. So that's good.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with any of that. Yeah. That's good to know they're thinking ahead of that.
Which is good, but at the same time, I don't know how that would affect, you know, the back-to-back road games and things like that. So there is that kind of little caveat that could happen.
Yeah, the only other thing of note to me that I've been chomping at the bit about is a lot of people who don't do a lot of the homework look at this schedule and say, okay, well, the Saints is probably a loss because they always play us well and whatnot. Well, the Saints have to come here in December, first of all. Ooh. Drew Brees never plays well in the cold.
Nope.
Doesn't really play that well on the road in general. And to the point of us never playing more than 2 games on the road at a time, that is the Saints' 3rd road game in a row.
Ooh.
So they already play on the road the previous 2 weeks and end that three-game road trip here. Like, I'm absolutely chalking that up as a win just based on that scheduling.
Yeah, and what I find funny is when people go through the schedule and predict wins and losses now, I feel like sometimes I'm the only person who has a theory like, okay, with every NFL season, there's at least one or two games where you know that they're going to lose, but they end up winning. And there's at least that many amount of games where you think it's a lock that they're definitely going to win, and then they lose. So there's,
yeah, I mean, it's all a futile exercise, but yeah. It's fun. We don't have a lot else going on, so why yeah. not? But yeah, so you said 10-6 and win the division. I originally said 12-4. If I have to, you know, bet either way, I'd probably lean toward 11-5. Obviously, like the, you know, that's a pretty easy thing to say, but I feel pretty good about 12-4. I went through and I chalked up my pretty surefire losses as being San Francisco, Baltimore, Seattle, and, you know, you figure one Dallas game, because predicting the sweep the division is crazy. Even 5-1's pretty tough sometimes, but I think the Giants and the Redskins are that bad that they can sweep them, and the schedule kind of works out pretty well for them against those teams too. The thing I would say is that I think probably betting on them beating both Cleveland and Green Bay, sandwiching that Seattle game, that's the toughest stretch to me.
Yeah.
You're at Cleveland, at home Monday night against Seattle, at Green Bay, at home against New Orleans. That's a tough stretch. Luckily, you know, it's road home, but I would much quicker say that they split the Cleveland-Green Bay thing and go 11-5 than I would think that they can win any of the games I'm chalking up as losses. And you also have to figure they're always going to lose that one that pisses you the fuck off that yeah. you never predict. Like
Seattle last year.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, Seattle's always good. That's why I'm yeah. giving them the benefit of the doubt this year, even though I would think on paper
and,
we're a
better
team.
Green Bay was a game last year that we thought they were
going
to lose.
Right.
And
Green Bay
won,
was like
so.
Undefeated going into that yeah. game, and we beat them. The trap game to me, I guess, if I'm looking at any of them, is probably that Arizona game, because like I said, I feel like we're going to win that Saints game, and I could see everybody riding really yeah. high. Maybe at that point we're already like, so what is that? That would be the 13th game, so you know maybe we're 9-4, we're feeling really good. We have to then go to Arizona, we lose, we're 9-5, now we're scared. Go to Dallas the next week, play for the division.
Yeah.
That's the reality. The other thing that Kyle Bennett had messaged me, the chief daddy of USP, had said is that if you're looking at the Eagles as like the team that wins the division and you're predicting their wins and losses, then you probably need to factor in that last week against Washington may not matter, and then maybe they lose that just yeah. out of not playing everybody. So like the point of me going 12-4, you know, if they go into that week 11-4 and already have the division, very good chance maybe they just drop that game, go 11-5.
Now going real back to Green Bay, I was making fun of our boy Jay Gibbs, who's a Packers fan. Do we see the Jordan Love era begin?
I don't think. Not sure by then, but we'll definitely give Jay a bunch of shit for the entire season for sure. All right, so we are going to get into the last dance, but first, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, the Andrew Boss team at Berkshire Hathaway. Who's the next person you know who will be buying or selling a home? Have them contact the Andrew Boss team at Berkshire Hathaway for the most trusted process when it comes to real estate in New Jersey. Call today, 856-904-5636. That's 856-904-5636. And mention Process Potables for exclusive savings. All right, so episode 7 of The Last Dance. This one started off, as we figured, based on the way it ended last week, with the first round series against the New Jersey Nets.
That's right.
Still the New Jersey Nets at that point that opened the playoffs of that 97-98 season. Steve, we were looking at some of the names on those jerseys, and I actually remember, you know, kind of enjoying that team. They were pretty fun to watch. That was right around, was 97-98, was that Iverson's rookie year?
I think so. Or maybe the year after.
Okay. But either way, so the Sixers were still a few years from really becoming, you know, an enjoyable watch, but we were getting Allen Iverson. I remember that Nets team being pretty fun. Obviously, they have Keith Van Horn, who Sixers fans are very familiar with. Who else is on that team?
Oh, so here you go. Their starting lineup, you're going to love this. You got Kendall Gill, Kerry Kittles, Chris Gatling, Sam Cassell, and Keith Van Horn.
That's and the starting lineup?
That was the starting lineup in game one of that series.
So who's the tallest guy in that lineup? Gatling?
Probably, yeah, or Keith Van Horn, because Keith Van Horn was
like 6'10".
Yeah, he was a pretty tall dude.
But he's not a center.
No, no way.
Wow.
But yeah, and my favorite name drop, Ronnie Cicely.
Ronnie Cicely.
Yeah.
So they didn't have, did they have Richard Jefferson then?
No.
Not yet, and they didn't have Kenyon Martin yet?
Nope, no Kmart, no Jay Rich.
Okay, so all those guys came after.
Yeah.
All right.
And I just, you got to love Jordan. He was just saying, we're going to beat them in our sleep, and they did.
Yeah, I mean, I believe he said something along the lines of, like, losing one game to them would be an embarrassment. They sweep the series 3-0. They go on. And then the series kind of fades back and talks about, you know, Jordan being emotionally and mentally exhausted. Well, they were saying they could see it in that series against the Nets, but then they used that to go back to him feeling the same way the summer of 1993, which is the summer that he inevitably announced his first retirement and then went on to play baseball. They talk about his relationship with his father, James Jordan. Then they start talking about his murder, which, again, was something we thought might come up this week. And this is where we've talked a few times in this series about, you know, whose perspective this is really being told from, and, you know, how much control does, like, Jordan have in what's getting out here and what's not. This was one of the most obvious parts where he clearly has complete control over what's coming out here.
Oh, sure,
because,
for sure.
Like, it is pretty crazy to think about connecting his vices, mainly gambling, to the death of his father. But it's not the most crazy thing, and it doesn't sound like anyone's ever really come up with anything better. Like, how would two random people just come across his dad on the side of the road, sleeping in his car? I don't know. Like, I don't think it's that. Like, I would never want to try and draw those conclusions or stir that kind of thing up. And the biggest thing was obviously, like, then kind of feeling the guilt of, my God, this is all happening in the media as he's actually trying to deal with the death of his father. Like, That's terrible. But they really, like, just brushed it completely to the side. Whereas, like, for example, later in the episode, they talk about was his whole baseball run the secret suspension from David Stern. Yeah. Like, it almost felt like they gave that more attention, because I'm sure he didn't want to talk about that either, but they dismissed that pretty readily too. But it almost seemed like they at least entertained that the slightest bit, because if you completely squash both of these things, then it's clear that there is no... Yeah. That is basically purely biased.
Yeah, because my understanding is back in that day, the whole narrative of the mob being owed money from Jordan and they took out his dad, that was a much bigger deal than what this documentary led on to believe.
Well, I mean, it was made out to be a bigger deal by the media is what you mean.
Exactly. And I think I personally feel that what happened is people are just trying to connect dots that don't exist. And I think it's more of a coincidence that a lot of the things happened in the order that they did. But people forget that David Stern turned the NBA, which was in a really bad spot in the late 80s, to the powerhouse that it is today, just being okay, worth,
well, you know, David Stern and Michael Jordan.
Oh, of course, Michael Jordan. But do you think David Stern, after those 3 years, Jordan winning the three-peat, like, you know what? Sit down. You're going to retire.
Yeah. So, and somebody says that in the episode. They say, yeah, David Stern's one of the biggest capitalists you'll ever
exactly.
meet.
Exactly. Yeah, because
you think he's going to tell his cash cow to go take a year and a half
exactly.
off?
That doesn't make sense
and
at all.
And handicap the league. Exactly. Yeah, there's no way that they would do that.
No one benefits from that.
Right. So I completely agree that the retirement angle was not even a thing. And Jordan obviously laughs at that. And that's what I'm saying, is I think that that one is much more laughable, yet that one seemed to almost get a little bit more, even in this, where neither gets much real recognition as even being potentially possibly true. I still feel like they at least slightly entertain the idea of the suspension in this series more than they do connecting his father's death to the gambling, which is where I disagree with this. I think that it is much more believable to connect his father's death to the gambling than it is to believe that he was secretly suspended.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
The other thing that I found interesting, this isn't something they talked about, but just something I said to you while we were watching, was the way the media spoke about him the first time he retired. They were saying as they were hearing he was going to retire, they were speaking, they were literally saying, the greatest basketball player of all time is about to announce his retirement. They were saying that then.
Yeah.
They were saying that in 1993. He had been in the league for 8 years, and he had won three titles, and they already thought he was the GOAT.
Yeah.
And people really have the nerve to try and argue today that anybody is better than him? They were saying it when he had three. Now he has six.
Yep.
It's
went
crazy.
6-0 in the NBA Finals in his lifetime.
The other thing that was interesting in talking about his retirement was that he literally says in his statement about retiring that there's a good chance he may play again. And he doesn't say good chance, but he says,
yeah,
you know, maybe
I don't remember that at all.
Maybe I'll get the itch to play. Maybe that'll be the challenge I need. Like, he was so much more conscious of all these things going on than I think anybody remembers or recognized at the time, or maybe even realizes now, like how ahead of the curve he was, especially without social media. Like, social media obviously brings out so much of the bad and amplifies so many situations that maybe people weren't aware of in the moment back then. But it also, like, social media helps you to have perspective because you're seeing everybody's thoughts and opinions and other sides of things and have so much more access to information, whether it be credible or not. You obviously have to figure that out for yourself. But the fact that he, without that kind of presence, was so conscious of so many things is one of the more impressive things to me throughout this entire series, just like how, like quote-unquote woke he was.
Yeah, and one thing that kind of stuck out, on top of him being woke, and not to jump ahead here, Michael Jordan's a crazy person. And
yes, absolute psychopath.
Absolute psychopath. And one thing that I felt they could have connected a little more was they talk about how in 92 he plays in the Olympics with the Dream Team, and we all see, you know, the infamous practice and how competitive he is. And you think about, there's that summer in 92, really, really no time off, no breaks. Not that he really takes time off ever. Wins another title, and then, you know, he has a summer, then wins the third title. And even as crazy and as competitive as how competitive he is, at some point it just must mentally get to him, like, dude, I need to stop. Like, this is madness. Like, the ongoing, like, the clock never stops.
Well, and again, I don't remember who it was. I want to say it was, like, his trainer or whatever that he worked with says that, you know, Jordan was telling him this was going to happen at the Olympics. He was telling him, like, you know, like, if I could just leave now, I would. Like, you know, I'm burnt out. I'm tired. He's like, but Magic never won three in a row. And Bird never won three in a row. So I have to go do that. And so then, obviously, he does it. And then you get to the point where it's like, all right, I did it. I did what nobody ever did.
What else is there?
What else can I do? Like, okay, like, you could go win four, but I think at that point, like, that wasn't enough to get him to go through it all again. And there's something to admire there. There really is. Like, it's a shame now, in retrospect, knowing that if he didn't take off, maybe he wins fucking eight.
Yeah.
But there's something to say to just being like, you know what? Like, I'm good. I don't think I'm going to have the motivation. And, like, think about it. If he goes into that next season, he stays. One, he's dealing with the death of his father, which probably fucks him up.
Yeah.
Two, he's beat the hell up. And three, like, just the odds of how many times you can actually win before somebody just upsets you. Like, and think of what it does to his legacy. Think if he goes in that next season and doesn't win.
Yeah.
We look at him entirely different. Like, it almost worked out so well for him that he took those 2 years off and recharged and came back so that he can have that 6-0. So he can have those two three-peats where if he still wins six but he loses the two in between, I mean, it's probably the same conversation. But, maybe he doesn't win the another three-peat because he just continues to wear out his body and his brain and everything. So it's so insane that, like, we've had all that information in front of us, but the way that this just puts some of those things in perspective and the way you're seeing it through people's, like, anecdotes and through his memory of it, like, that's where it really makes the whole thing more interesting to me.
And I just kind of thought about this, how a lot of people, there's, like, these boomer takes where when athletes take games off, you know, for load management and things like that, there's always that, oh well, back in my day we played every minute, we played 110% every single minute, we put our bodies on the line,
right?
And obviously Jordan's the exception here, but both physically and mentally, like, you saw how much it got to this guy. Like, it makes you wonder, like, if he had those games off where he just, you know, I need a day off. It maybe he doesn't have, you know, those that 1.5 year off from basketball.
When you look back at those, yeah, I mean, you could look. I mean, you could look at a guy like Larry Bird and say, you know, what if he just had some fucking load management?
Oh yeah.
To all, and those and the people that are fans of him are the same guys who are banging the desk saying, "Oh, back in my day, guys never took games off." Yeah, and Larry Bird had to cut his career short because his back was so fucked up because he just played too much and like he was also like a sloppy fuck out there. So like it goes both ways, and people just never want to admit it, but. So we go on to Jordan playing baseball. There's not a whole lot interesting here, except that I had no idea Terry Francona was his manager.
Yeah, seriously.
Very, very funny to see that. Obviously, former Red Sox manager, former Phillies manager. And this is the one thing where I haven't just come out and blatantly said that I thought really anybody on this series, for the most part, has come and said flat-out lies in like interviews that they're doing now, like if they, you know, back then, did a lot of these guys maybe say stuff that we know was disingenuous or not true at the time? Sure, maybe, whatever. But most of the interviews they're doing now, like in retrospect for this documentary, like kind of believe that at least they believe what they're saying. Like if it's not something that's strictly fact or fiction, if, you know, if it's an emotional thing that they are truly saying how they believe that they felt or something. But Terry Francona came out and said that he believed that if Jordan had 1,500 at bats, he'd have found a way to the majors. No. And I believe Jerry Reinsdorf later says something along the same lines, that he thinks Jordan would have made it. Bullshit.
No.
He would have never made it. They got right into it early, that after he had like a 13-game hitting streak and they were only throwing him fastballs, that they started throwing him breaking balls and he couldn't hit shit. They said he batted 202. With 50 RBIs, to which they said the 50 RBIs was a damn good number, and sure, maybe it was. But 202 is not. Ty Daubert, friend of the pod, who hasn't been on in a while, was texting me this whole episode saying that Tim Tebow's better than Michael Jordan.
Ouch.
And that Michael Jordan's like career slugging was something like 360.
Yeah, so in the 300s,
right? Let me see if I have it.
Right.
260 slugging percentage.
Oh, below 300. Wow.
Yeah, so a slugging percentage of 260. Like, that's pretty fucking bad.
Yeah.
Like, all-time awful. So, no, I don't believe that at all. I believe Terry Francona, and the way that I have always perceived him is that he's a fucking coward, and I think he didn't want to ruffle any feathers, and he was just sucking Michael Jordan's dick to suck Michael Jordan's dick. And you know what? Fine. Like, do you. But that was bullshit.
I just love how he brings up how he first was like, "Hi, I'm Terry," like just Terry Francona. he totally got out.
Just no sold it.
Yeah, that's probably the only time in his minor league coaching career
he was in witness protection or something, and he couldn't actually reveal his identity.
Hi, I'm Terry.
I'm Terry. So they go on to talk about the Bulls that first season without him. They make the playoffs. Pippen's an MVP candidate, and then they have this infamous situation where they're tied against, it's the Knicks, right?
Yes, yeah, against the Knicks.
They're tied against the Knicks, and Phil Jackson draws up a final play for Tony Kukoc, which they had run at least a couple times that season and had success with, that Tony had hit the shots, and Pippen gets really mad that he's not the guy getting the chance since he's been the best player all year, and he refuses to go in the game. Phil says, fuck him, and they go out and they run the play, and Tony hits the shot and they win the game, which is just so epic and absolutely is one of the biggest W's for Phil Jackson in this entire series. And they pretty much all seem like they said that Pippen apologized, and you know, we both listened to Horace Grant on Part of My Take, and he talked about that story a lot, and he was very close with Pippen, you know, the whole time that they were teammates, and he says that, you know, he talked to Scotty after, and that Scotty was remorseful and that, you know, he apologized to the team and everything. And when I had heard the Horace Grant interview, I guess like a week ago at this point, and I was like, oh, you know, like it's nice to hear that even though he did a shithead move that it sounds like he like learned from it and regretted it. And then literally in this fucking documentary, he sits there and goes, yeah, you know, I apologize to the teammates and everything, but if I had to redo all that again, I'd probably do the same thing.
Yeah.
Why the fuck would you say that?
Even if you felt that way, you don't say that. The one thing this episode I walked away with, like, Scottie Pippen definitely kind of went down a few pegs for me. And I kind of...
We'll save it for the... We'll do our...
Yeah. But I kind of...
Power rankings.
One thing I kind of took away is everyone always has this comment where a lot of times, and people said in a documentary, a lot of times when Scottie was playing next to MJ, he looked like the second best player, not only on a team, but in the league. You know, he was a top three, top five player. And it kind of dawned on me at some point, I'm like, you know what, like, for someone who was that good, that valued, you don't hear from him as much in this documentary. I know there's the one episode where they talked a lot about Scottie Pippen. And if you know Scottie Pippen real well, hearing him talk at length is just really excruciating and nauseating. But for how big of a role he had, he definitely seems to not be in it as much. And it just kind of makes you wonder.
I mean, that's kind of the story of that entire run, was that he was the sidekick.
Yeah.
And the documentary is also fully just, you know, cementing that fact. In both, you know, the film and the portrayal, and also in the way that they're, you know, letting him tell the story, or how much of his story they're allowing him to tell. But at the same time, I mean, it also speaks to the way the dynamic worked with the team. I mean, Jordan was the leader. He was the vocal one, and Pippen really wasn't that guy. And guys gave him credit for doing it when Jordan was gone, but they even talked about it in this. Like, Steve Kerr mentions how Scottie was the supportive type, and he would, you know, come and pat you on the back and tell you, you know, you'll be fine, we'll get through it. Whereas Jordan was the one challenging everybody and wanting to beat their ass and basically threatening them harm if they didn't do their job. So, you know, I would also wonder how much Pippen wanted to talk for this, how much he really gave them that was useful or worthwhile. And you know, that could be the result of it as well.
I also did like when they talked about that first season without MJ, they said Phil Jackson coached arguably his best year without Jordan, and they said how they ran a triangle offense to perfection. And while they were talking about it, they just show basically the ball being swung around the court, and Scottie Pippen's just very passive. Like, I think, I think on two occasions he passed up a wide open shot.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh my God, if I'm watching that game, I'm like shouting at my TV, like, Scottie, what the fuck are you doing?
I almost did here, because both times I'm like, oh, we're going to see him shoot. And I was like, wait, what? You're right. He passed it up twice, and I agree.
Like, you're the guy now. I know you're the point forward, but come on.
And then you're complaining that you're not getting the opportunity to shoot it in a situation mm-hmm. where you're passing up that
like
shot
that,
in game. Yeah, great point. So they go on to sweep the Nets in the first round of the playoffs, and then the Hornets are their second round opponent. And we get the B.J. Armstrong game. And that was kind of the running theme of both episodes tonight, was basically, who's the guy that's going to motivate Michael Jordan for the next few games? So B.J. Armstrong basically, you know, wins game two and kind of taunts Michael Jordan and the Bulls as they walk off the court. And everyone's like, oh, shit, here we go. Then you hear about the Bradford Smith game. And this was like, this was probably the biggest psychopath moment that we find out about Michael Jordan through eight episodes. So this was still in the seventh, but there was nothing in the eighth that makes me change my mind that this was the biggest indicator that this guy is actually a psychopath. Like, sometimes you say it for fun, and then sometimes you're like, no, actually,
no, he's crazy.
He's crazy. Yeah. So the Bradford Smith game, I believe they said he played on the Bullets.
Washington Bullets.
I don't know if at that point they're the Wizards or the Bullets.
They were the Bullets,
I think they're the Bullets, yeah. So, he was a rookie, and he scores 37 against the Bulls, even though they still lost the game. The Bulls won that game, which I felt like was completely overshadowed in them discussing.
Yeah, they kind of made it seem
like they
did.
It's not even like he beat Jordan. He just scored 37, which, you know, great. But then apparently, you know, Michael Jordan goes out and says that this guy at the end of the game said, "Nice game, Mike." And it really pissed them off. And it motivated him. And that night, Jordan shot like 6 of 21 and didn't have a good game. Again, even though they won. And then apparently they were playing a back-to-back. So that was in Chicago. The Bulls then go to Washington. And Jordan says, I'm going to do what he did in the whole game last night in the first half tonight. And sure enough, Jordan goes out and scores 36 in the first half.
Yeah, he's a psychopath.
Well, not yet. At that point, you're like, okay, this is the story. Is people motivate him, and they talk shit, and then they pay for it. And why aren't people learning this lesson? Then you come to find out that Jordan made the whole thing up. that guy never said a word to him.
Nope.
And that he made the thing up to motivate himself. That's where you realize that, like, that is the difference between him and anybody else. Like, I've seen people piss off LeBron James and him use that. But I don't believe that LeBron James can manifest fantasies in his mind to take his game to a next level. Like, somebody would have to do it. Somebody would have to say something to him. Somebody would have to say something to the media to get under his skin and cause him to go to that next level. Where Michael Jordan said, if he had a bad game, all right, like, my brain, my subconscious is going to make up bullshit that will fuel me to be better. That's unheard of to me and absolutely insane. So at that point, the series is 1-1, and they go on to beat the Hornets 4-1. The Hornets don't win another game.
Nope. Oh, and that's get a couple of Matt Geiger cameos in that footage.
Yeah, I'm sure you enjoyed that. Yeah. I know how big a fan of Matt Geiger you are.
Hey, I'm the only Matt Geiger fan.
Sure, if you say so.
I mean, I'm not proud of
that. I don't
know
any others, so.
No, not even Matt Geiger likes himself.
So episode 8 starts off with talking about the baseball strike of 95. This obviously leads to Jordan coming back to the NBA as he refused to cross the picket line and play with the replacement players. So then he runs into BJ Armstrong, and who at that time was still a Bull, because now we're jumping back to 95. And BJ Armstrong invites him to come, you know, say hi to the team as he had to go to practice. So Jordan goes, and apparently then, like, I think he said him and BJ Armstrong play one-on-one, because BJ said, you know, you haven't played, I can beat your ass now. And then it starts getting reported that Jordan's attending, you know, 2 to 3 practices a week and ramping up, and it's probably a matter of time until he comes back, and then inevitably he comes back. So he comes back, what, I think not till February of that season, so there's only like 2 months left.
Yeah, he only played 17 games, I think.
Okay,
it was.
So maybe even later than that.
Yeah, maybe in early March.
So, you know, they show some clips of like the first game he comes back and plays, and he looks a little sloppy, doesn't have his legs completely under him, but it's there. He comes back wearing the 45. He says that was his first number. He said, you know, he didn't feel like 23 anymore. I think there was something to do with his dad as well in regards to the 45, so whatever. But the best part about all of this was Patrick Ewing, who me and you have always hated and love to relentlessly make fun of, and I think is one of the more overrated basketball players in NBA history. And they talk about Michael Jordan returning to the Garden at a point where he was still kind of figuring everything out and hadn't really, you know, found his game yet. And he shows up at the Garden and drops 55. And Patrick Ewing says that, I think I had a great game too, but nobody remembers because Jordan scored 55. And me and you both looked at each other and said, that's his entire career.
Yes.
Is Patrick Ewing having good games that nobody remembers because his stats were insignificant and that team never did anything and he's fucking trash?
Fuck the Knicks. Fuck Patrick Ewing.
So
fuck
that
the
was
Garden.
Amazing. Really enjoyed that. One of the highlights of the entire series for me. Anytime I can dunk on Patrick Ewing the way Scottie Pippen did, I'm pretty happy. They started talking about Space Jam. There wasn't really a whole lot here. I was hoping we might get some like B-sides of him like actually filming, but we didn't get anything good like that. We saw him like dribbling into a bunch of green skin guys.
Yeah, a bunch of green men.
Yeah. But the interesting thing here that I didn't know, I don't know if you had ever heard stories about this, was that they built him his own entire, you know, basketball practice facility, fully enclosed, full court, with like gym equipment and everything. And Jordan was inviting like the top young NBA talent to go there, and they were just running pickup games. So this is very kind of similar to that 92 Dream Team kind of feel. Not the same level as the 92 Dream Team, obviously. Like, that was almost all Hall of Famers, but you know, all the league's top talent there running, and that really is like getting Jordan back into peak shape to go for that next three-peat, which is like, not only was he scouting a lot of the new guys he hadn't played against, but they're, you know, showing him the level he has to get back to succeed. And it's just funny thinking about it now, being like, you all set yourself up for failure. Like, think if he doesn't get that summer running pickup games with the best guys in the league. Do you think he comes back in the same shape? Do you think he really, like, you know, sharpens the tools as much as they need to be to go out and win a title the immediate next season? Like, if you don't do that, then maybe that first season back, he's not ready, and he takes the season still to ramp up, and they don't win that year.
Yeah, maybe. And I didn't even realize that he was – training that much while filming a movie. Like, that's crazy.
It's funny to hear Reggie Miller talk about it and be that amazing. Yeah. When you consider at that point that Reggie Miller had just entered the league, and Jordan at that point is already in his early 30s, and Reggie's the one saying, like, I don't know how he's doing this. He's showing up to film at 6 or 7 a.m. He's filming all day. He's working out. And then we're playing pickup basketball till 9, 10 p.m. Then he's working out more, and then he's getting up the next day and shooting again, filming.
The only thing I've seen closest to that is The Rock's Instagram when he wakes up at, you know, 4 in the morning to work out and shoots a movie for 16 hours and then eats 100 pancakes and then, like, on 3 hours of sleep, like...
Yeah, but even then, The Rock is only just doing, like, bodybuilding, which is still is obviously demanding, but
he's not
also training to play another professional sport.
And when it's
and that training is basically part of his acting, because all of his roles are based on him being that big and that in shape and that intimidating for the most part, whether it's used, you know, seriously or ironically, obviously. They go on to talk about the infamous fight with Steve Kerr in a practice in that first season back. And the only thing I really got from this was just looking at Steve Kerr both now and back then and thinking, you know, I don't ever claim to be tough. I've never really been in, like, a real fight. But I'm pretty confident that Steve Kerr could punch me as hard as he wants and I could just take it, no problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the comedy of thinking about him punching Michael Jordan in, you know, the peak of his career in the chest and thinking that's a good idea, I don't get it. Like we said, all sides have indicated this guy's a psychopath. But, you know, I can respect when you get pushed to the brink that you react, and I would probably do the same. I'm definitely not mild-mannered. I definitely don't keep my cool. So I can see that sometimes you just got to swing, and I respect it. And, hey,
it paid off. It was ballsy.
Well, he got punched in the eye, but, you know, other than that, it earned his respect. And, you know, again, it all just ties back to the fact that Michael Jordan's a psychopath. But, you know, sometimes the way to get to the heart of somebody crazy is to show that you're a little crazy too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The next thing is they talk about the finals in which they beat the Sonics. I found this very interesting, as I've never really seen any much from the series. I haven't really heard all that much about it. I don't remember, like, watching this, because the only series I remember watching as a kid were the last two Jazz series.
Yeah.
In full, at least. So I don't even, if I caught any of this, I don't know, because I guess I was six or seven. But George Karl was the coach of the Sonics in 95-96 when
That's
they went to
crazy.
The finals. I had no idea.
No, I thought it was Lenny Wilkins, but I was like, shit, really, George Karl? Like, and hey, even back then, George Karl's still the asshole that we know him today.
Yep, and you would find that out because, again, who pissed off Jordan to motivate him? Well, it seems like this time it was George Karl, because apparently him and Jordan go way back to North Carolina. And, you know, several other instances that Jordan names on the documentary that, you know, he's known George Karl for a very long time. And apparently George Karl just completely, like, blew him off at the beginning of the series. Didn't, you know, say hi to him, didn't shake his hand, didn't acknowledge him. And again, at that point, and a guy like George Karl is not a player who is, you know, mentally devoid of a lot of these things. Like, you're the head coach of the opposing team. Like, your job is to manage personalities, to understand these things, like, you know, to even instruct your team, like, whether you want to, like, you know, maybe tell them, like, you know, don't stare down Jordan, don't piss off Jordan. Like, you know,
leave that to Gary Payton.
Right. And that's what I mean. If you have the one guy that you're like, you know what, like, go say something to him, it's Gary Payton.
Yeah.
But not only does George Karl do all this and piss off Jordan, but we find out that he adamantly made sure to not let Gary Payton guard Michael Jordan, because they didn't want to burn him out at both ends, and they wanted him to be their scorer, because even though he had won Defensive Player of the Year, he was also their best offensive player. Sean Kemp, you know, a rim runner and an okay shooter, but Gary Payton being really their best scorer as well, says they're going to need him. And, like, it makes sense, but you're also playing Michael fucking Jordan.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? So they go down 3-0. Another thing I notice, so they go down 3-0, and then we get Gary Payton. We get a lot of Gary Payton, which I loved, because
him and
Sean Kemp are two of my all-time favorites that don't have, you know, a Philadelphia connection. They are my NBA Jam duo, and both tremendously talented players. that Gary Payton says, like, fuck you, George Karl. I'm going to defend Michael Jordan, and I'll score. And, you know, plays him pretty well, which is a little bit surprising to me, considering, like I know how good Gary Payton is, but this is Michael Jordan. And we're talking about Michael Jordan at, like, 6'6". You know, again, at his peak, Gary Payton was, I don't know, 6'2", maybe?
If that, yeah. And you're down 0-3 to the team. It's like, you're really going to, I mean, you don't have anything to lose at that point. So it was impressive.
But, yeah, so he gets them to 3-2, and they show the clip of them winning Game 5 in Seattle and confetti coming down. So my first question to you, Steve, is what is the bigger misuse of confetti? Winning the fifth game of an NBA Finals to get yourself to still being down 3-2, or thinking you beat the Boston Celtics in a playoff game and then finding out that it was actually only a tie?
Ooh, that's really tough, but I think the Sonics one is worse.
Good, so do I.
Yeah, because again, you're down 0-3, like, there's no
team... I might
team
be biased, but...
Yeah,
probably
definitely
biased. Definitely biased.
Yeah.
The other question, a little bit more serious, who do you blame more for not letting Gary Payton guard Michael Jordan sooner? George Karl or Gary Payton?
I think it's got to be George Karl. One, because I hate George Karl and I love Gary Payton.
True, but, and I'm with you there, but like, it is kind of like fucked up that it took Gary Payton until 03 to be like, all right, you know what? Fuck it, I'll do this.
And he even said himself he was Defensive Player of the Year that year, and you're not going to defend the best player on the court.
Yeah.
Was it a size mismatch? Yes, but if you're that good of a defender, you should be able to stop anyone.
And listen, maybe it's semantics to say game two or game three, but like, again, game one, your coach says, this is what we're doing, fine. And then, you know, that game wasn't all that close. Then I think the second game, they only lost by 4. So, like, maybe the second game, you're like, fine, like, I'll stick with what coach says. Then you only lose by 4. So maybe that's the reason that then you're still not panicking. But I still think that, like, 0-2, you have to be like, all right, like, we changed something now. I don't know. And, again, probably doesn't matter, but fault on both ends. But it's a little disappointing knowing Gary Payton, thinking that he might have jumped at that opportunity sooner. He ends up not doing so. And clearly it worked for a little bit, but didn't really change it in the end anyway. And that was pretty much it. It looks like next week we're going to start off probably with the Eastern Conference Finals, which will be Reggie Miller and the Pacers.
That's going to be really good.
But again, this brings me back to my point that it's just very, very surprising that we haven't really seen or heard from anybody around the Jazz to this point, when they were their opponents not only in the Last Dance Finals, but the year before as
yeah,
well.
I mean, maybe the last episode is just going back and forth between those 2 years.
Maybe.
So.
And I know we had said, I think we said either the second or maybe it was last weekend or the weekend before that, I had actually read somewhere that they were still doing interviews for this while it's been airing. So, like, when, like, episodes 1 and 2 aired, they weren't done filming all 10 of them.
Yeah.
And that it was either that week, like, either after the first weekend or the second weekend, like, they were still filming interviews with guys like John Stockton, and I'm guessing probably a lot of the Jazz people, since that was toward the end of it anyway. So, I don't know, maybe there's just maybe it has something to do with it getting moved up, and the fact that, like, maybe you could have pieced segments from those guys in earlier episodes had this all been done prior to it airing, but obviously if you're kind of getting them out as they go,
right,
that you don't have that benefit. But still, like, I mean, I hate that fucking Jazz team, like, really bad. I never really liked John Stockton, even though people at least seem to, you know, pretty much appreciate him. I always fucking hated Karl Malone. I think he's a giant dork. And really just never liked anything to do with the Jazz. Who was their coach? Jerry Sloan?
Yeah, Jerry Sloan.
Fucking hated him, too. Like, hate. Was that Greg Ostertag? Was that?
Yeah,
was
Greg Ostertag.
Greg Ostertag.
Yep.
Like, fuck that whole team. But, like, I really thought that we were going to get a lot more on that rivalry. And it almost seems like they're not even, like, considered rivals as far as the series goes. Like, we've seen them be considered rivals with the Bad Boy Pistons. We've seen them being rivals with the New York Knicks.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we're going to get it.
Yeah, maybe. Hey, they're just saving the best for last.
I hope it is the best for last. It's been really good so far. I think me and you both agreed, like you had said earlier, that last weekend was a little disappointing. Definitely not the best episodes, but this weekend, I think it picked back up. Hopefully, we're in for a real nice home stretch. Next Sunday, episodes 9 and 10, wrapping up The Last Dance. I'm already getting anxiety thinking about what we're going to have after that. It's giving me major Game of Thrones vibes going through that season.
And that's just a good way of putting it.
And just knowing it's coming to the end. And one, do I trust them to end it well? I feel a lot better about The Last Dance than I did Game of Thrones. I'll give it that at least. But also, like, I'm just preparing for this void. And what do I fill it with besides drugs? Because don't want to do
beer. That. We're a beer podcast.
That's true. I guess it's beer, but you know, we can't really go to beer. We can sit here and drink it, which is fine. I do like to do that on occasion. Yeah. But so that's all I've got for this one, Steve. Anything else you want to add? Anything you want to hit before we head out?
Thank God that school is not physically in session, because, dude, tomorrow morning Scott Burrell's kids would get the fuck bullied out of them. Seeing just like MJ clowning on him, like that's a theme that I didn't.
Oh, power, power rankings.
Yeah, we got to do the power rankings.
All right. All right, your biggest riser and your biggest fall from this episode.
my biggest rise is Gary Payton, man. Like Gary Payton, I know this is a weird way of putting it, but when you admire players who are not on your team that you root for. He was that guy where when I would play NBA Live back in the day, I traded for Gary Payton. He was always my point guard on the team. He was the man. And you kind of forget just the shit that he talked. And, man, like, he talked shit, but he backed it up. He was so damn good, and that's on both ends of the floor. The person who went down, like I said earlier, would definitely be Scottie Pippen for reasons I already explained. But, George Karl definitely remains bad always in my book. And LeBradford Smith, man, that he gets an honorable mention. Not that he really rise or went down.
I'm taking all my options, man. Come on. Yeah, I mean, those were my Pippen was one of mine. And when you went there, I was going to say George Karl. You kind of said that too. And then Bradford Smith was going to be my sleeper. So you're fucking everything up for me.
Sorry.
Biggest riser to me, I don't know if you caught this, one of the biggest risers to me for this one was Horace Grant. Because it was very funny that in talking about a series with the Bulls and the Magic, where the Magic had both Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway, that the only person we heard from was Horace Grant. And also that it was talked about how Horace Grant left to be a star with the Orlando Magic. I'm sorry. When I think about an Orlando Magic team, I think of Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway. And then I think of, like, I don't know, B.J. Armstrong? Yeah,
Nick Anderson.
Yeah, Nick Anderson. Like, there are a lot of people I think of before I think of Horace fucking Grant at that point.
Yeah, I think even Scott Skiles played on that team.
So I definitely think that Horace Grant was given a big bump here that I don't necessarily agree with, but I'll give. The other one, and, like, in any episode, I'd feel like this is a cop-out, but this is the only one I think is fair. Michael Jordan, because while I think we all know that he was a shit baseball player, they made it seem like he had a lot better chance of getting somewhere than I think anybody is willing to remember or believe, between Jerry Reinsdorf and from Terry Francona both saying that they believed he would have gotten to the majors. No fucking way. You're just being nice, and I get it, but fuck you, you're lying. And then I guess, anybody else falling? I guess if I'm going to put George Karl in there, I am unfortunately going to put Gary Payton in there too. Just because, again, I take a little bit of issue with a guy like Gary Payton, who's given credit for being so tough and being such a dog, to wait until you're down 0-3 in the NBA Finals to decide to guard the opposing team's best player. I don't know. That really hurts me, being a Gary Payton fan, to hear that was the case.
Yeah. And one of my favorite headlines from a shots of newspapers and articles was Error Jordan. I just enjoyed that one.
That was very good.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Very punny.
Gotta love a good pun here and there. All right, so thanks everybody for listening. By the way, we did finally hit 100 ratings on Apple Podcasts, so thank you everybody who did that. The climb to 200 begins now. I think we're actually at like 101 or 102, so we're already on the way.
Sweet.
But I will not be very annoying for a long time now until we start finally approaching 200. But hopefully, you know, it happens naturally. We get a couple here and there. So if you're listening now and you haven't done so, please go to Apple Podcasts, give us that 5-star rating, leave a review. Also do that for Power Bombs and Potables, Underground Sports Philadelphia, everybody that's a part of the family. If you are into professional wrestling, me and Corey did a Money in the Bank preview and the weekly show's recap 2 days ago on Friday. That has already been put up. And as we are recording this, Corey has our friend Joe Sheehan of the Super Smart Brothers podcast joining him to do the Money in the Bank recap.
And yes, that's the same Joe Sheehan from the Cardboard Classic.
That is the same Joe Sheehan from the Cardboard Classic who never got us any footage of it, despite him somehow winning because we interviewed him, because they were the first
people to get
the Process Potables bump. So good for them, but fuck you, Joe Sheehan.
Fuck you, Joe Sheehan.
So make sure you check that out if you're in the professional wrestling. It is being reported to me. Can never be sure, but it is being reported to me that Mason and Mike will have their first episode of Pucks and Potables recorded this Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
So assuming I get it Wednesday, I will work to get it up late Wednesday, depending on when I get it, or no later than Thursday. That will be in our feed for now, as they don't have their own because I never set it up because I'm busy. I will do that. But for now, in our feed, you'll get that. And we're also starting another podcast called Popcorn and Potables.
Get your popcorn ready.
Because we're just going to keep fucking making shit up.
That's right.
And drinking while we do it. Our friend Mike D'Amore will be hosting that. I forget what he said his co-host name is.
I think her name's Mary.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, we'll find out.
Stay tuned.
With his friend Mary as a co-host, we'll be talking mostly movies, working on talking about box office numbers, what's coming out. Obviously, right now during quarantine, that's going to be a little bit rough. So we're mostly just going to talk about whatever movies we want. And then once things hopefully get back to normal at some point, we'll get into more of a set routine on what we're exactly covering as far as, you know, the news and updates and setting the table for what we plan to talk about in a more specific sense. That should be coming bi-monthly at the least, and including a lot of bonus content with everybody from the Podcast Potables Network jumping in for their areas of expertise, plus guests outside of our network as well. So stay tuned for that. We are always expanding, always looking. If you have any interest in possibly being a content creator, whether that be writing for the blog portion of the website, whether that be jumping on any of our established podcasts, starting a new podcast, you can always email us at processpotables@gmail.com. We will happily have any conversation with you about that. Also, Underground Sports Philadelphia is looking for potential new applicants, whether that be for a summer kind of internship or possibly for just like a full-time gig. It is not paying, obviously, but we need content creators, producers, editors, everything like that. So if you go to Underground PHI on Twitter, you can find a link to the application for that that you can submit and will be reviewed. This Wednesday, there will be a new episode of Underground Sports Philadelphia, the flagship podcast, and I should be on that one, talking some Eagles betting lines for the season and talking about the schedule on there. So if you're looking for Eagles content, I mean, every USP episode has Eagles content, so you can definitely check out whatever's latest on the feed right now. But I'm pretty sure that another episode will come this Wednesday, and I'll be jumping on that as a guest, so stay tuned for that. I think that covers everything else. So for Steve, I'm Dan. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and trust the podcast.